spacious for the slender man, now that it had been stripped of its cushions and coverings. The two Olav warriors, with their helmets and shields bearing the sign of the cross that Lavrans had carved into the armrests of the high seat, scowled glumly and morosely under Erland's slim tan hands. No man could carve foliage and animals more beautifully than Lavrans, but he had never been very skilled at capturing human likenesses. The silence between them was so complete that not a sound was heard except for the hollow thudding out on the green, where the horses were plodding around in the summer night.
"Aren't you going to bed soon, Kristen?"
he finally asked.
"Aren't you?"
"I thought I would wait for you," said her husband.
"I don't want to go yet. I can't sleep."
After a moment, he asked,
"What is weighing so heavily on your heart, Kristen, that you don't think you'll be able to sleep?"
Kristen straightened up. She stood holding a skein of heather green wool in her hands, tugging and pulling on it with her fingers.
"What was it you said to Nokva today?"
She swallowed a couple of times. Her throat felt so parched.
"Some piece of advice?
He didn't think it was much good for him. But the two of you talked about Ivar and Skule."
"Oh, that."
Erland gave a little smile.
"I just told the boy. I do have a son-in-law, now that I think of it. Although Gerlach wouldn't be as eager to kiss my hands or carry my cape and sword as he used to be. But he has a ship on the sea and wealthy kin, both in Bremen and in Lynn. Surely the man must realize that he's obliged to help his wife's brothers. I didn't stint on my gifts when I was a rich man and married my daughter to Gerlach T. Dickinson."
Kristen did not reply. At last, Erland exclaimed vehemently,
"Jesus, Kristen, don't just stand there staring like that, as if you had turned to stone."
"I never thought that, when we were first married, that our children would have to roam the world, begging food from the manners of strangers."
"No. And the devil take me, I don't mean for them to beg. But if all seven of them have to grow their own food here on your estates, then it will be a peasant's diet, my Kristen. And I don't think my sons are suited to that. Ivar and Skule look like they'll turn out to be daredevils. And out in the world there is both wheat bread and cake for the man willing to slice his food with a sword."
"You intend your sons to become hired soldiers and mercenaries?"
"I hired on myself when I was young and served Earl Jakob. May God bless him, I say. I learned a few things back then that a man can never learn at home in this country, whether he's sitting in splendor in his high seat with a silver belt around his belly and swilling down ale, or he's walking behind a plow and breathing in the farts of the farm horse. I lived a robust life in the Earl's service. I say that even though I ended up with that stump chained to my foot when I was no older than Nokva. But I was allowed to enjoy some of my youth."
"Silence!"
Kristen's eyes grew dark.
"Wouldn't you think it the most unbearable sorrow if your sons should be lured into such sin and misfortune?"
"Yes. May God protect them from that. But surely it shouldn't be necessary for them to copy all the follies of their father. It is possible, Kristen, to serve a noble lord without being saddled with such a burden.
It is written that he who draws his sword shall lose his life by the sword, Erlan."
"Yes, I've heard that said, my dear. And yet most of our forefathers, both yours and mine, Kristen, died peacefully and in a Christian manner in their beds, with the last rites and comfort for their souls. You only need think of your own father. He proved in his youth that he was a man who could use his sword."
"But that was during a war, Erlan. At the summons of the king to whom they had sworn allegiance. It was in order to protect their homeland that father and the others took up their weapons. And yet father said himself that it was not God's will that we should bear arms against each other, baptized Christian men."
"Yes, I know that. But the world has been this way ever since Adam and Eve ate from the tree. And that was before my time. It's not my fault that we're born with sin inside us."
"What shameful things you're saying."
Erland heatedly interrupted her.
"Kristen, you know full well that I have never refused to atone and repent for my sins as best I could. It's true that I'm not a pious man. I saw too much in my childhood and youth. My father was such a dear friend of the great lords of the chapter. They came and went at his house like gray pigs. Lord Eilev, back when he was a priest, and Herr Sigvat Launde, and all the others, and they brought little else with them but quarrels and disputes. They were hard-hearted and merciless toward their own bishop. They proved to be no more holy or peaceable, even though each day they held the most sacred relics in their hands and lifted up God himself in the bread and wine. Surely we are not to judge the priests. That's what Father always said. It's our obligation to bow before the priesthood and obey them. But their human behavior shall be judged by God alone. Yes, well. Erland hesitated. I know he said that. And you've also said the same in the past. I know you're more pious than I can ever be. And yet, Kristen, I have difficulty accepting that this is the proper interpretation of God's words, that you should go about storing everything away and never forgetting. He had a long memory too, Lavrans did. No, I won't say anything about your father except that he was pious and noble, and you are too, I know that. But often when you speak so gently and sweetly, as if your mouth were full of honey, I fear that you're thinking mostly about old wrongs, and God will have to judge whether you're as pious in your heart as you are in words. Suddenly Kristen fell forward, stretched out across the table, with her face buried in her arms, and began shrieking. Erland leaped to his feet. She lay there, weeping with raw, ragged sobs that shuddered down her back. Erland put his arm around her shoulder. Kristen, what is it? What is it? He repeated, sitting down next to her on the bench and trying to lift her head. Kristen, don't weep like this. I think you must have lost your senses.
I'm frightened.
She sat up, wringing her hands together in her lap.
I'm so frightened. Gentle Virgin Mary, help us all. I'm so frightened. What will become of my sons?
Yes, my Kristen. But you must get used to it. You can't keep hiding them under your skirts. Soon they'll be grown men, all our sons. And you're still acting like a bitch with pups. He sat with his legs crossed and his hands clasped around one knee, looking down at his wife with a weary expression. You snap blindly at both friend and foe over anything that has to do with your offspring. Abruptly, she got to her feet and stood there for a moment, mutely wringing her hands. Then she began swiftly pacing the room. She didn't say a word, and Erland sat in silence, watching her.
Skule.
She stopped in front of her husband.
You gave your son an ill-fated name. But you insisted on it. You wanted the Duke to rise up again in that child.
It's a fine name, Kristen. Ill-fated. That can mean many things. When I revived my great-grandfather through my son, I remembered that good fortune had deserted him, but he was still a king, and with better rights than the comb-maker's descendants.
You were certainly proud, you and Munan Bardson, that you were close kinsmen of King Håkon Haaland.
Yes. You know that Svira's lineage gained royal blood from my father's aunt, Margaret Skule's daughter.
For a long time, both husband and wife stood staring into each other's eyes.
Yes. I know what you're thinking, my fair wife.
Erland went back to the high seat and sat down. With his hands resting on the heads of the two warriors, he leaned forward slightly, giving her a cold and challenging smile.
But as you can see, my Kristen, it hasn't broken me to become a poor and friendless man. You should know that I have no fear that the lineage of my forefathers has fallen along with me from power and honor for all eternity. Good fortune has also deserted me. But if my plan had been carried out, my sons and I would now have positions and seats at the king's right hand, which we, his close kinsmen, are entitled to by birth. For me, no doubt, the game is over. But I see in my sons, Kristen, that they will attain the positions which are their birthright. You don't need to lament over them, and you must not try to bind them to this remote valley of yours. Let them freely make their own way. Then you might see before you die that they have once again won a foothold in their father's ancestral regions.
Oh, how you can talk.
Hot, bitter tears rose up in his wife's eyes, but she brushed them aside and laughed, her mouth contorted.
You seem even more childish than the boys, Erlan. Sitting there and saying, when it was only today that Nokfa nearly won the kind of fortune that a Christian man can hardly speak of, if God hadn't saved us.
Yes, and I was the one lucky enough to be God's instrument this time.
Erlan shrugged his shoulders. Then he added in a somber voice,
such things. You needn't fear, my Kristen. If this is what has frightened you from your wits, my poor wife.
He lowered his eyes and said almost timidly,
you should remember, Kristen, that your blessed father prayed for our children, just as he prayed for all of us, morning and night. And I firmly believe that salvation can be found for many things, for the worst of things, in such a good man's prayers of intercession.
She noticed that her husband secretly made the sign of the cross on his own chest with his thumb. But as distressed as she was, this only infuriated her more.
Is that how you console yourself, Erlan? As you sit in my father's high seat? That your sons will be saved by his prayers, just as they are fed by his estates?
Erlan grew pale.
Do you mean, Kristen, that I'm not worthy to sit in the high seat of Lavrans Bjørgulfsson?
His wife's lips moved, but not a word came.
Erlan rose to his feet. Do you mean that? For if you do, then as surely as God is above us both, I will never sit here again. Answer me,
he insisted when she remained standing in silence. A long shudder passed through his wife's body. He was a better husband, the man who sat there before you. Her words were barely audible.
Guard your tongue now, Kristen.
Erlan took a few steps toward her. She straightened up with a start.
Go ahead and strike me. I've endured it before, and I can bear it now.
I had no intention of striking you.
He stood leaning on the table. Again they stared at each other, and his face had that oddly unfamiliar calm she had seen only a few times before. Now it drove her into a rage. She knew she was in the right. What Erlan had said was foolish and irresponsible, but that expression of his made her feel as if she were utterly wrong. She gazed at him, and feeling sick with anguish at her own words, she said,
I fear that it won't be my sons that will thrive once more among your lineage in Trøndelag.
Erlan turned blood red.
You couldn't resist reminding me of Suniva Olav's daughter, I see.
I wasn't the one to mention her name.
You did.
Erlan blushed even more.
Haven't you ever thought, Kristen, that you weren't entirely without blame in that misfortune? Do you remember that evening in Nidaros? I came and stood by your bed. I was terribly meek and sad about having grieved you, my wife. I came to beg your forgiveness for my wrong. You answered me by saying that I should go to bed where I had slept the night before.
How could I know that you had slept with the wife of your kinsman?
Erlan was silent for a moment. His face turned white and then red again. Abruptly, he turned on his heel and left the room without a word. Kristen didn't move. For a long time, she stood there motionless, with her hands clasped under her chin, staring at the candle. Suddenly, she lifted her head and let out a long breath. For once, she had been forced to listen. Then she became aware of the sound of horse hooves out in the courtyard. She could tell from its gait that a horse was being led out of the stable. She crept over to the door and out onto the gallery and peered from behind the post. The night had already turned a pale gray. Out in the courtyard stood Erlan and Ulf Haldorsson. Erlan was holding his horse,
and she saw that the animal was saddled and her husband was dressed for travel. The two men talked for a moment, but she couldn't make out a single word. Then Erlan swung himself into the saddle and began riding north at a walking pace toward the manor gate. He didn't look back, but seemed to be talking to Ulf, who was striding along next to the horse. When they had disappeared between the fences, she tiptoed out, ran as soundlessly as she could up to the gate, and stood there listening. Now she could hear that Erland had let Sultan begin trotting along the main road. A little later, Ulf came walking back. He stopped abruptly when he caught sight of Kristen at the gate. For a moment, they stood and stared at each other in the gray light. Ulf had bare feet in his shoes and was wearing a linen tunic under his cape. "What is it?" his mistress asked heatedly. "Surely you must know, for I have no idea."
"Where was he riding off to?" she asked.
"To Haugen." Ulf paused. "Erland came in and woke me. He said he wanted to ride there tonight, and he seemed in a great hurry. He asked me to see to it that certain things were sent to him up there later on."
Kristen fell silent for a long time. "He was angry?"
"He was calm." After a moment, Ulf said quietly, "I fear, Kristen. I wonder if you might have said what should have been best left unspoken."
"Surely Erlan for once should be able to stand hearing me speak to him as if he were a sensible man," said Kristen vehemently.
They walked slowly down the hill. Ulf turned toward his own house, but she followed him.
"Ulf, kinsman," she implored him anxiously. "In the past, you were the one who told me morning and night that for the sake of my sons, I had to steel myself and speak to Erlan."
"Yes, but I've grown wiser over the years, Kristen." "You haven't," he replied in the same tone of voice.
"You offer me such solace now," she said bitterly.
He placed his hand heavily on the woman's shoulder, but at first he didn't speak. As they stood there, it was so quiet they could both hear the endless roar of the river, which they usually didn't notice. Out across the countryside, the roosters were crowing, and the cry of Kristen's own rooster echoed from the stable.
"Yes, I've had to learn to ration out the solace sparingly, Kristen. There's been a cruel shortage of it for several years now. We have to save it up, because we don't know how long it might have to last."
She tore herself away from his hand. With her teeth biting her lower lip, she turned her face away. And then she fled back to the hearth house. The morning was icy cold. She wrapped her cloak tightly around her and pulled the hood up over her head. With her dew-drenched shoes tucked up under her skirts and her crossed arms resting on her knees, she huddled at the edge of the cold hearth to think. Now and then a tremor passed over her face, but she did not cry. She must have fallen asleep. She started up with an aching back, her body frozen through and stiff. The door stood ajar. She saw that sunlight filled the courtyard. Kristen went out onto the gallery. The sun was already high. From the fenced pasture below, she could hear the bell of the horse that had gone lame. She looked toward the new storehouse. Then she noticed that Munan was standing up on the loft gallery, peering out from between the posts. Her sons. It raced through her mind. What had they thought when they woke up and saw their parents' bed untouched? She ran across the courtyard and up to the child. Munan was wearing only his shirt. As soon as his mother reached him, he put his hand in hers, as if he were afraid. Inside the loft, none of the boys was fully dressed. She realized that no one had woken them. All of them looked quickly at their mother and then glanced away. She picked up Munan's leggings and began helping him to put them on.
"Where's father?" asked Lavrans in surprise.
"Your father rode north to Haugen early this morning," she replied. She saw that the older boys were listening as she said,
"You know he's been talking about it so long, that he wanted to go up there to see to his manor."
The two youngest sons looked up into their mother's face with wide, astonished eyes.
But the five older brothers hid their gaze from her as they left the loft.
Chapter 3. The days passed. At first, Kristen wasn't worried. She didn't want to ponder over what Erland might have meant by his behavior, fleeing from home like that in the middle of the night in a fit of rage, or how long he intended to stay north on his upland farm, punishing her with his absence. She was furious at her husband, but perhaps most furious because she couldn't deny that she too had been wrong and had said things she sincerely wished had not been said. Certainly she had been wrong many times before, and in anger she had often spoken mean and vile words to her husband. But what offended her most bitterly was that Erland would never offer to forget and forgive unless she first humbled herself and asked him meekly to do so. She didn't think she had let her temper get the better of her very often. Couldn't he see that it was usually when she was tired and worn out with sorrows and anguish, which she had tried to bear alone? That was when she could easily lose mastery over her feelings. She thought Erland might have remembered, after all the years of worry she had borne about the future of their sons, that during the past summer she had twice endured a terrible agony over Nokva. Her eyes had been opened to the fact that after the burdens and toil of a young mother comes a new kind of fear and concern for the aging mother. Erland's carefree chatter about having no fear for the future of his sons had angered her until she felt like a wild she-bear or like a bitch with pups. Erland could go ahead and say that she was like a female dog with her children. She would always be alert and vigilant over them for as long as she had breath in her body. If, for that reason, he chose to forget that she had stood by him every time it mattered with all her strength, and that she had been both reasonable and fair in spite of her anger, when he struck her and when he betrayed her with that hateful, loose woman from Lensvik, then she could do nothing to stop him. Even now, when she thought about it, she couldn't feel much anger or bitterness toward Erland over the worst of the wrongs he had done her. Whenever she turned on him to complain about that, it was because she knew that he regretted it himself. He knew it was a great offense. But she had never been so angry with Erland, nor was she now, that she didn't feel sorrow for the man himself when she remembered how he struck her or betrayed her, with everything that followed afterward. She always felt that with these outbursts of his unruly spirit, he had sinned more against himself and the well-being of his own soul than he had against her. What continued to vex her were all the small wounds he had caused her with his cruel nonchalance, his childish lack of patience, and even the wild and thoughtless kind of love he gave her whenever he showed that he did indeed love her. And during all those years when her heart was young and tender, when she realized that neither her health nor her strength of will would be sufficient, as she sat with her arms full of such defenseless little children, if their father, her husband, didn't show that he was both capable and loving enough to protect her and the young sons in her arms. It had been such torment to feel her body so weak, her mind so ignorant and inexperienced, and yet not dare rely on the wisdom and strength of her husband. She felt as if she had suffered deep wounds back then, which would never heal. Even the sweet pleasure of lifting up her infant, placing his loving mouth to her breast, and feeling his warm, soft little body in her arms was soured by fear and uneasiness. So small, so defenseless you are, and your father doesn't seem to remember that above all else he needs to keep you safe. Now that her children had gained marrow in their bones and metal in their spirits, but still lacked the full wisdom of men, now he was luring them away from her. They were whirling away from her, both her husband and all her sons, with that strange boyish playfulness which she seemed to have glimpsed in all the men she had ever met, and in which a somber, fretful woman could never participate. For her own sake, then, she felt only sorrow and anger whenever she thought about Erland. But she grew fearful when she wondered what her sons were thinking.
Ulf had gone up to Dovre with 2 pack horses and taken Erland the things he had sent for. Clothing and a good many weapons, all 4 of his bows, sacks of arrow points and iron bolts, and 3 of his dogs. Munan and Lavrans wept loudly when Ulf took the small, short-haired female with the silky, soft, drooping ears. It was a splendid foreign animal which the Abbot of Holm had given to Erlon. That their father should own such a rare dog seemed, more than anything else, to elevate him above all other men in the eyes of the 2 young boys. And their father had promised that when the dog had pups, they would each be allowed to choose one from the litter. When Ulf Haldorsson returned, Kristin asked him whether Erland had mentioned when he intended to come back home.
No, said Ulf. It looks like he means to settle in up there.
Ulf volunteered little else about his journey to Haugen, and Kristin had no desire to ask. In the fall, when they moved from the new storeroom into other quarters, her oldest son said that this winter they wanted to sleep upstairs in the high loft. Kristin granted them permission to do so. She would sleep alone with the 2 youngest boys in the main room below. On the first evening, she said that now Lavrans could sleep in her bed as well. The boy lay in bed, rolling around with delight and burrowing into the ticking. The children were used to having their beds made up on a bench, with leather sacks filled with straw and furs to wrap around them. But in the beds there was blue ticking to lie on and fine coverlets, as well as furs, and their parents had white linen cases on their pillows.
Is it just until father comes home that I can sleep here? Asked Lavrans. Then we'll have to move back to the bench, won't we, mother?
Then you can sleep in the bed with Nokva and Björgulf, replied his mother. If the boys don't change their minds, that is, and move back downstairs when the weather turns cold. There was a little brick fireplace up in the loft, but it produced more smoke than heat, and the wind and cold were felt much more in the upper story. As the fall wore on, an uncertain fear crept over Kristin. It grew from day to day, and the strain was difficult to bear. No one seemed to have heard from Erlon or seen him. During the long, dark autumn nights she would lie awake, listening to the even breathing of the 2 little boys, noting the swirl of the wind around the corners of the house, and thinking about Erlon. If only he wasn't staying at that particular farm. She hadn't been pleased when the 2 cousins had begun talking about Haugen. Munan Bardsson was visiting them at the hostel in Oslo on one of the last evenings before their departure. Back then, Munan had inherited sole ownership of the small manor of Haugen from his mother. Both he and Erland had been quite drunk and boisterous, and when she sat there feeling tormented by their talk of that place of misfortune, Munan suddenly gave Erland the farm, so that he wouldn't be entirely bereft of land in Norway. This happened amid much bantering and laughter. They even jested about the rumors that no one could live at Haugen because of the ghosts. The horror that Sir Munan Bardsson had harbored in his heart ever since the violent death of his mother and her husband up there now seemed to have eased somewhat. He ended up giving Erlund the deed and documents to Haugen. Kristin couldn't hide her displeasure that he had become the owner of that ignominious place. But Erlund merely jested,
"It's unlikely that either you or I will ever set foot in those buildings. If they're still standing, that is, and haven't collapsed. And surely neither Aunt Osheild nor Herr Bjorn will bring us the land rent themselves. So it shouldn't matter to us if it's true what people say, that they still haunt the place."
The year came to an end, and Kristin's thoughts were always circling around one thing. How was Erlon doing up north at Haugen? She grew so reticent that she barely spoke a word to her children or the servants, except when she had to answer their questions. And they were reluctant to address their mistress unless it was absolutely necessary, for she gave such curt and impatient replies when they interrupted and disturbed her restless, anxious brooding. She was so unaware of this herself that when she finally noticed that the 2 youngest children had stopped asking her about their father or talking about him, she sighed and concluded that children forget so quickly.
but she didn't realize how often she had scared them away with her impatient words when she told them to keep quiet and stop plaguing her. To her oldest sons, she said very little. As long as the hard frost lasted, she could still tell strangers who passed by the manor and asked for her husband that he was up in the mountains trying his luck at hunting. But then a great snowfall descended upon both the countryside and the mountains during the first week of Advent. Early in the morning on the day before St. Lucia's Day, while it was still pitch dark outside and the stars were bright, Kristen came out of the cowshed. She saw by the light of a pine torch stuck in a mound of snow that three of her sons were putting on their skis outside the door of the main house, and a short distance away stood Gauta's gelding with snowshoes under its feet and packs on its back. She guessed where they were headed, so she didn't dare say a word until she noticed that one of the boys was Björgulf. The other two were Nokva and Gauta.
"Are you going out skiing, Björgulf? But it's going to be clear today, son."
"As you can see, Mother, I am."
"Perhaps you'll all be home before the holy day?" she asked helplessly. Björgulf was a very poor skier. He couldn't tolerate the brilliance of the snow in his eyes and spent most of the winter indoors. But Nokva replied that they might be gone for several days. Kristen went home feeling fearful and uneasy. The twins were cross and sullen, so she realized that they had wanted to go along, but their older brothers had refused to take them. Early on the fifth day, around breakfast time, the three boys returned. "They had left before dawn for Björgulf's sake," said Nokva, "in order to reach home before the sun came up." The two of them went straight up to the high loft. Björgulf looked dead tired. But Gauta carried the bags and packs into the house. He had two handsome pups for the small boys, who at once forgot all about their questions and grievances. Gauta seemed embarrassed but tried not to show it. "And this," he said as he took something out of a sack, "this father asked me to give to you. 14 marten pelts, exceedingly beautiful." Kristen took them, greatly confused. She couldn't utter a single word in reply. There were far too many things she wanted to ask, but she was afraid of being overwhelmed if she opened even the smallest part of her heart. And Gauta was so young. She could only manage to say, "They've already turned white, I see." "Yes, we're deep into the winter half of the year now." When Nokva came downstairs and he and Gauta sat down to the porridge bowl, Kristen quickly told Frida that she would take food to Björgulf up in the loft herself. It occurred to her that she might be able to talk about things with the taciturn boy, who she knew was much more mature in spirit than his brothers. He was lying in bed, holding a linen cloth over his eyes. His mother hung a kettle of water on the hook over the hearth, and while Björgulf propped himself up on his elbow to eat, she boiled a concoction of eyebright and celandine. Kristen took away the empty food bowl, washed his red and swollen eyes with the concoction, and placed moist linen cloths over them. Then she finally gathered her courage to ask, "Didn't your father say anything about when he intends to come back home to us?"
"No."
"You always say so little, Björgulf," replied his mother after a moment.
"That seems to run in the family, Mother."
After a pause, he continued, "We met Simon and his men north of Rost Gorge. They were headed north with supplies."
"Did you speak to them?" she asked.
"No," he said with a laugh. "There seems to be some kind of sickness between us and our kinsmen that makes it impossible for friendship to thrive."
"Are you blaming me for that?" fumed his mother. "One minute you complain that we talk too little, and the next you say that we can't keep our friends."
Björgulf merely laughed again. Then he lifted himself up on his elbow, as if he were listening to his mother's breathing.
"In God's name, Mother, you mustn't cry now. I'm tired and dejected, unaccustomed as I am to traveling on skis. Pay no mind to whatever I say. Of course I know that you're not a woman who's fond of quarrels."
Kristen then left the loft at once. But she no longer dared, for any price, to ask this son what her children thought of these matters. She would lie in bed, night after night, when the boys had gone up to the loft, listening and keeping watch. She wondered whether they talked to each other when they were alone up there. She could hear the thump of their boots as they dropped them to the floor, the clatter of their knife belts falling. She heard their voices but couldn't make out their words. They talked all at the same time, growing boisterous. It seemed to be half quarrel, half banter. One of the twins shouted loudly. Then something was dragged across the floor, making dust sprinkle down from the ceiling into the main room. The gallery door crashed open with a bang. There was a stomping from outside on the gallery, and Ivar and Skula threatened and carried on as they pounded on the door. She heard Gauta's voice, loud and full of laughter. She could tell that he was standing just inside the door. He and the twins had been fighting again, and Gauta had ended up throwing the twins out. Finally, she heard Nokva's grown-up man's voice. He intervened, and the twins came back inside. For a little while longer, their chatter and laughter reached her, and then the beds creaked overhead. Gradually, silence fell. Then a steady drone interrupted by pauses could be heard, a drone like the sound of thunder deep inside the mountains. Kristen smiled in the dark. Gauta snored whenever he was especially tired. Her father had done the same. Such similarities pleased her. The sons who took after Erlund in appearance were also like him in that they slept as soundlessly as birds. As she lay in bed, thinking about all the small likenesses that could be recognized in offspring, generation after generation, she had to smile to herself. The painful anguish in her heart loosened its grip for a moment, and the trance of sleep descended, tangling up all the threads of her thoughts as she sank down. First into well-being, and then into oblivion. They were young, she consoled herself. They probably didn't take it so hard. But one day, shortly after New Year's, the curate Sira Solman came to see Kristen at Urengard. It was the first time he arrived uninvited, and Kristen welcomed him courteously, even though she had her suspicions at once. And it turned out just as she had thought. He felt it was his duty to inquire whether she and her husband had arbitrarily, and without church consent, ended their marriage, and, if so, which of the spouses was responsible for this unlawful act. Kristen felt as if her eyes flitted restlessly, and she spoke too swiftly, using far too many words, as she explained to the priest that Erlan thought he should tend to his property up north in Dovre. It had been sorely neglected over the past few years, and the buildings were apparently in ruins. Considering that they had so many children, they needed to look after their welfare, and many other such matters. She gave much too detailed an account of the situation, so that even Sira Solmun, as dull-witted as he was, had to notice that she was feeling uncertain. She talked on and on about what an eager hunter Erlund was. Surely the priest must know that. She showed him the marten pelts she had received from her husband, and in her confusion, before she realized it or could reconsider, she gave them to the priest. Anger overtook her after Sira Solman had gone. Erlan should have known that if he stayed away in this manner, their priest, being the kind of man he was, would show up to investigate the reason for his absence. Sira Solman was a little trifle of a man in appearance. It wasn't easy to guess his age, but he was supposedly about 40 winters old. He was not very shrewd, and apparently didn't possess an overabundance of learning, but he was an upright, pious, and moral priest. One of his sisters, an aging, childless widow and a wicked gossip, managed his meager household. He wanted to be seen as a zealous servant of the church, but he concerned himself mostly with paltry matters and common folk. He had a timid disposition and was reluctant to meddle with the gentry or take up difficult questions, but once he did so, he grew quite fierce and stubborn. In spite of this, he was well liked by his parishioners. On the one hand, People respected his quiet and honorable way of living. On the other hand, he was not nearly as avaricious or strict when it came to the rights of the church or people's obligations as Sira Eirik had been. This was doubtless due to the fact that he was much less bold than the old priest. But Sira Eirik had loved and respected every man and every child in all the surrounding villages. In the past, people often grew angry when the priest strove, with unseemly greed, to secure the fortunes and wealth of the children he had conceived out of wedlock with his housekeeper. During the first years he lived in the parish, the people of Seal had a difficult time tolerating his imperious harshness toward anyone who overstepped the slightest dictate of church law. He had been a soldier before he took his vows, and he had accompanied the pirate earl, Sir Alf of Tornberg, in his youth. This was all quite evident in his behavior. But even back then, the people had been proud of their priest, for he surpassed nearly all other parish priests in the realm in terms of knowledge, wisdom, physical strength, and courtly manners. He also had the loveliest singing voice. As the years passed and he had to endure the heavy trials God seemed to have placed on his servant because of his willfulness in his youth, Sira Eirik Karason grew so much in wisdom, piety, and righteousness that his name was now known and respected throughout the entire bishopric. When he journeyed to ecclesiastical meetings in the town of Hamar, he was honored as a father by all the other priests, and it was said that Bishop Hallvard wanted to have him moved to a church which would have granted him a noble title and a seat in the cathedral chapter. But Sira Eirik supposedly requested to stay where he was. He gave his age as his excuse, and the fact that his sight had been failing him for many years. On the main road at Seal, a little south of Formo, stood the beautiful cross carved from soapstone that Sira Eirik had paid to have erected, where a rock slide on the slope had taken the lives of both his promising young sons 40 years before. Older people in the parish never passed that way without stopping to say a Pater Noster and Ave Maria for the souls of Alf and Kara. The priest had married off his daughter with a dowry of property and cattle. He gave her to a handsome farmer's son of good family from Viken. No one had any other thought but that Jan Fies was a good lad. 6 years later, she had returned home to her father, starving, her health broken, wearing rags and full of lice, holding a child by each hand, and with another one under her belt. The people living in Seal back then all knew, although they never mentioned it, that the children's father had been hanged as a thief in Oslo. The sons of Jan didn't turn out well either, and now all three of them were dead. While his offspring were still alive, Sira Eirik had greedily sought to adorn and honor his church with gifts. Now it was the church that would doubtless acquire the majority of his fortune and his precious books. The new St. Olav and St. Thomas Church in Seal was much larger and more splendid than the old one that had burned down, and Sira Eirik had endowed it with many magnificent and costly adornments. He went to church every day to say his prayers and to reflect, but now he only said Mass for the parishioners on high holy days. It was Sira Solmund who now handled most of the other official priestly duties. But when people had a heavy sorrow, or if their souls were troubled by great difficulties or pangs of conscience, they preferred to seek out their old parish priest, and they all felt that they took home solace from a meeting with Sira Eirik. One evening in early spring, Kristin Lavran's daughter went to Romengard and knocked on the door of Sira Eirik's house. She didn't know how to bring up the subject she wanted to discuss, so she talked about one thing and another after she had expressed her greetings. Finally, the old man said a little impatiently, "Have you just come here to bring me greetings, Kristin, and to see how I am? If so, that is most kind of you. But it seems to me that you have something on your mind, and if this is true, tell me about it now, and don't waste time with idle talk." Kristin clasped her hands in her lap and lowered her eyes. "I'm so unhappy, Sira Eirik, that my husband is living up there at Haugen." Surely the road isn't any longer, said the priest, than that you can easily journey up there to talk to him and ask him to return home soon. He can't have so much to do up there on such a small one-man farm that he should need to stay any longer.
I feel frightened when I think of him sitting alone up there in the winter nights, said Kristin, shivering.
Erland Nicholason is old enough and strong enough to look out for himself.
Sarah Eirik, you know about everything that happened up there, back in the old days, whispered Kristin, her voice barely audible.
The priest turned his dim old eyes toward her. Once they had been coal black, sharp, and gleaming. He didn't say a word.
Surely you must have heard what people say,
she continued, speaking in the same low voice,
that the dead still haunt the place.
Do you mean you don't dare seek him out because of that? Or are you afraid the ghosts might break your husband's neck? If they haven't done it by now, Kristin, then no doubt they'll let him stay there in peace. The priest laughed harshly. It's mostly just ignorance. Heathen nonsense and superstition, when people start gossiping about ghosts and the return of dead men. I fear there are stern guards at the door in that place where Herr Bjorn and Fru Oshild now find themselves.
Sarah Eirik, she whispered, her voice trembling. Do you believe there is no salvation for those two poor souls?
God forbid that I should dare judge the limits of his mercy. But I can't imagine that those two could have managed to settle their debts so quickly. All the slates the two of them have had a hand in carving have not yet been presented. Her children, whom she abandoned, and the two of you, who took lessons from the wise woman. If I thought that it might help, so that some of the misdeeds she committed could be rectified. But since Erland is living up there, God must not think it would be of any benefit for his aunt to reappear and warn him. For we know that it is through the grace of God and the compassion of Our Lady and the intercessionary prayers of the Church that a poor soul may be allowed to return to this world from the fires of purgatory if his sin is such that it can be absolved with the help of someone who is alive and in this manner shorten his time of torment. Such was the case with the wretched soul who moved the boundary between Hove and Jarpstad. Or the farmer in Musudal with the false documents about the millstream. But souls cannot leave the fires of purgatory unless they have a lawful errand. It's mostly nonsense what people say about ghosts and phantoms or the mirages of the devil, which disappear like smoke if you protect yourself with the sign of the cross and the name of the Lord.
But what about the blessed ones who were with God, Sarah Eirik? She asked softly.
You know quite well that the holy ones who are with God can be sent out to bring gifts and messages from paradise.
I once told you that I saw Brother Edvin Rikardsson, she said in the same tone of voice.
Yes, either it was a dream, and it might have been sent by God or one of his guardian angels, or else the monk is a holy man.
Shivering, Kristin whispered, My father, Sarah Eirik, I have prayed so often that I might be allowed to see his face one more time. I long so fervently to see him, Sarah Eirik. And perhaps I might be able to tell from his expression what he wants me to do. If my father could give me advice in that way.
She had to bite her lip, and she used a corner of her wimple to brush away the tears that had welled up. The priest shook his head. Pray for his soul, Kristin. Although I'm convinced that Lavrans and your mother have long ago found solace with those from whom they sought comfort for all the sorrows they endured here on earth. And certainly Lavran still holds you firmly in his love there too. But your prayers and the masses said for his soul will bind you and all the rest of us to him. How this occurs is one of the secret things that are difficult to fathom. But I have no doubt that this is a better way than if he should be disturbed in his peace to come here and appear before you.
Kristin had to sit still for a moment before she gained enough mastery over herself that she dared speak. But then she told the priest about everything that had happened between Erland and her on the evening in the hearth house, repeating every word that was said
as best as she could remember. The priest sat in silence for a long time after she was finished. Then Kristen clapped her hands together harshly.
Sarah Eirik, do you think I was the one most at fault? Do you think I was so wrong that it wasn't a sin for Erlund to desert me and all our sons in this manner? Do you think it is fair for him to demand that I seek him out, fall to my knees, and take back the words I spoke in anger? Because I know that unless I do, he will never return home to us.
Do you think you'd need to call Lavrans back from the other world to ask his advice in this matter?
The priest stood up and placed his hand on the woman's shoulder.
The first time I saw you, Kristen, you were a tiny maiden. Lavrans made you stand between his knees as he crossed your little hands on your breast and told you to say the Pater Noster for me. You repeated it in a lovely, clear voice, even though you didn't understand a single word. Later, you learned the meaning of every prayer in our language. Perhaps you've forgotten about that now. Have you forgotten that your father taught you and honored you and loved you? He honored the man before whom you are now afraid of humbling yourself. Or have you forgotten how splendid the feast was that he held for the two of you? And then you rode away from his manor like two thieves. Did you take with you Lavrans Björgulfsson's esteem and honor? Sobbing, Kristen hid her face in her hands. Do you remember, Kristen? Did he ever demand that the two of you should fall to your knees before he thought he could take you back into his fatherly love? Do you think it too harsh a penance for your pride if you have to bow before a man whom you may not have wronged as much as you sinned against your father?
Jesus.
Kristen wept in utter despair.
Jesus, have mercy on me.
I see that you at least remember his name, said the priest. The name of the one your father strove to follow like a disciple and serve like a loyal knight.
He touched the small crucifix that hung above them.
Free of sin, God's son died on the cross to atone for the sins we had committed against him. Go home now, Kristen, and think about what I have told you, said Sarah Eirik after she had regained some measure of calm.
But during those very days, a southerly gale set in with sleet and torrential rains. At times it was so fierce that people could barely cross their own courtyards without the risk of being swept away above all the rooftops. At least that was how it seemed. The roads through the countryside were completely impassable. The spring floods arrived so abruptly and turbulently that people had to move out of the estates that were most vulnerable. Kristen moved most of their belongings up into the loft of the new storehouse, and she was granted permission to put her livestock in Sarah Eirik's springtime shed. The shed used at Jurengard in the spring was on the other side of the river. It was a dreadful toil in the storm. Up in the meadows, the snow was as soft as melted butter, and the animals were so wretched. Two of the best calves broke their legs as if they were tender stalks as they walked along. On the day they moved the livestock, Simon Dara suddenly appeared in the middle of the road with four of his servants. They set about lending a hand. In the wind and rain and all the tumult with the cattle that had to be prodded and the sheep and lambs that had to be carried, there was neither peace nor quiet for the kinsmen to talk. But after they returned to Jurengard in the evening and Kristen had seated Simon and his men in the main house, everyone who had helped out that day needed some warm ale. He spoke a few words with her. He asked her to go to Formo with the women and children, while he and two of his men would stay behind with Ulf and the boys. Kristen thanked him but said that she wanted to stay on her manor. Lavrans and Munan were already at Ulfsvold, and Jartrud had gone to stay with Sira Solman. She had become such good friends with the priest's sister. Simon said, "People think it's strange, Kristen, that you two sisters never see each other. Romborg won't be happy if I return home without you."
"I know it looks strange," she told him, "but I think it would look even stranger if we should visit my sister now, when the master of this estate is not home, and people know that there's animosity between him and you."
Then Simon said no more.
and soon after he and his men took their leave. The week preceding Ascension Day arrived with a terrible storm, and on Tuesday word spread from farm to farm in the north of the region that the floods had now carried off the bridge up in Roast Gorge, which people crossed when they went up to the hovering pastures. They began to fear for the big bridge south of the church. It was solidly built of the roughest timbers, with a high arch in the middle, and was supported underneath with thick posts that were sunk into the riverbed. But now the waters were flooding over the bridge heads where they joined the banks, and beneath the vault of the bridge all kinds of debris that had been brought by the currents from the north were piling up. The log had now overflowed the low embankments on both shores, and in one place the water had accumulated across Urengard's fields like in a cove, almost reaching the buildings. There was a hollow in the pastures, and in the middle was the roof of the smithy, and the tops of the trees looked like little islands. The barn on the islet had already been swept away. Very few people attended church from the farms on the east side of the river. They were afraid the bridge would be washed away and they wouldn't be able to get back home. But up on the other shore, on the slope beneath Laugarbrew's barn, where there was some shelter from the storm, a dark cluster of people could be glimpsed through the gusts of snow. It was rumored that Sira Eirik had said he would carry the cross over the bridge and set it on the east bank of the river, even if no one dared follow him. A squall of snow rushed toward the procession of people coming out of the church. The flakes formed slanting streaks in the air. Only a glimmer of the valley was visible. Here and there a scrap of the darkening lake where the fields usually lay. The rush of clouds sweeping over the scree-covered slopes and the lobes of forest, and glimpses of the mountain peaks against the billowing clouds high overhead. The air was sated with the clamor of the river, rising and falling, with the roar from the forests, and with the howl of the wind. Occasionally a muffled crash could be heard, echoing the storm's fury from the mountains and the thunder of an avalanche of new snow. The candles were blown out as soon as they were carried beyond the church gallery. That day, fully grown young men had donned the white shirts of choir boys. The wind whipped at their garments. They walked along in a large group, carrying the banner with their hands, gripping the fabric so the wind wouldn't shred it to pieces as the procession leaned forward, struggling across the slope in the wind. But now and then, above the raging of the storm, the sound of Sira Eirik's resonant voice could be heard as he fought his way forward and sang.
Venite, revertamur ad Dominum, quia ipse sepit, e sanabit nos, percutiet, e curabit nos, e vivemos in conspectu eos, sciemus sequer murque, ut conoscamus Dominum. Alleluia.
Kristen stopped, along with all the other women, when the procession reached the place where the water had overflowed the road. But the white-clad young boys, the deacons, and the priests were already up on the bridge, and almost all the men followed. The water came up to their knees. The bridge shuddered and shook, and then the women noticed that an entire house was rushing from the north toward the bridge. It churned around and around in the current as it was carried along, partially shattered, with its timbers jutting out, but still managing to stay in one piece. The woman from Ulvsvold clung to Kristin Lavran's daughter and moaned loudly. Her husband's two nearly grown-up brothers were among the choir boys. Kristen screamed without words to the Virgin Mary, fixing her gaze on the group in the middle of the bridge, where she could discern the white-clad figure of Nokva among the men holding the banner. The women thought they could still hear Sira Eirik's voice, almost drowned out by the din. He paused at the crest of the bridge and lifted the cross high up as the house struck. The bridge shuddered and swayed. To the people on both shores, it looked as if it had dipped slightly to the south. Then the procession moved on, disappearing behind the curved arch of the bridge, and then reappearing on the opposite shore. The wreckage of the house had become tangled up in the heaps of other flotsam, caught in the underpinnings of the bridge. All of a sudden, like a miracle, silvery light began seeping from the wind-blown masses of clouds, A dull gleam like molten lead spread over the whole expanse of the swollen river. The haze lifted, the clouds scattered, the sun broke through, and as the procession came back over the bridge, the rays glittered on the cross.